Hello and welcome to SOC Unlocked, Tales from the Cybersecurity Frontline. I'm Mick Leach, your host and guide on this exciting journey into the SOC universe. In each episode, I chat with various cybersecurity professionals about the latest industry news, emerging threats, practical strategies to keep your organization safe, and more. And this week, we are excited to have Eric Zielinski, a dear friend. Eric, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Mick. Happy to be here.
Awesome. Well, for those who don't know, and most won't, Eric and I worked together in a previous life. It feels like a lifetime ago, but we worked together at an insurance company in the Midwest a long time ago, and so I'm excited to partner with Eric on this discussion. And with that, Eric, I'd love to have our listeners learn a little bit more about you. Tell us about yourself, your journey into cybersecurity. How did you get here?
Sure, I'd love to. I started my cybersecurity journey way back in the late 1900s. Oh, I sound so old just saying that, but it's true. I actually got started working for a internet service provider in the late 90s during the dot-com boom. And that's where I learned my basics of system admin, networking, troubleshooting. I was supporting dial-up internet. You had to dial up using a modem to connect to the internet, right? Remember those days? I kind of lucked out in getting into cybersecurity because that company ended up filing bankruptcy and I had to find, you know, my next gig. And so I was perusing the local newspapers. Back then you had to search for a job in the classified section of the newspaper. You couldn't go on the internet and look for jobs like you can these days.
Monster.com days even.
Yeah, even premonster.com, right? And so I found this startup that was run by a couple of ex-military folks that were doing the very beginnings of cybersecurity. And they were looking for somebody that had some networking background and some firewall experience. And so I thought, hey, that sounds kind of cool. Let me check that out. So I start at this startup and we're doing the very beginnings of vulnerability management, threat intelligence, logging and monitoring. I was literally monitoring firewall logs and IDS sensor logs without a SIM. Like the SIM wasn't even invented. And I'm looking for anomalies in all of this log data and trying to notify clients when something bad is happening.
Now, quick question before you go. Was that pre-Snort days too?
I think Snort was around at that point. Okay. Yeah, I do believe so. Yeah, because there was like one book on cybersecurity, and I think it was Snort, and it was like 300 pages. but that's when I really fell in love with cybersecurity. And after that, I did some consulting. I did some attack and penetration testing work, did some more vulnerability management, and then moved into a Fortune 100 insurance company where I spent probably about 16 years of my career doing all different types of cybersecurity roles. In that position, I was able to do risk assessments, compliance. I used to get paid. This was awesome. I used to get paid to literally drive around the campuses with a giant coffee can hanging out of my window that was built as a Wi-Fi antenna that I was using to scan for unauthorized wireless access points.
War driving. I have not heard about war driving in probably 15 years.
Yeah, I thought it was the coolest thing ever. The security guards would always give me funny looks. I'm just driving by and I've got my little antenna hanging out of my window, scanning for unauthorized Wi-Fi access points. So I did that. But I really fell in love with digital forensics and incident response. I did that for about 8 years. Just loved the whole problem solving, you know, detective mentality, worked towards building out Cyber Fusion Center for the company. It's whenever I met you, Mick, and, you know, we had a lot of fun adventures building out that Cyber Fusion Center, maturing the Security Operations Center, building out threat intel, and then moved into cloud security. And so started, you know, doing some basics of, all right, let's figure out how we're going to migrate these applications on-prem into the cloud securely. And so was able to put that together for that company and build out their cloud operations organization, moved on to life science industry after that. Worked on their security operations, did vulnerability management, EDR, threat intel, security ops work. for a SaaS-based company, and then took a CISO role for a desktop as a service company and got a chance to really run the cybersecurity program end to end and really feel that, provide strategy, provide some, insights and direction on how to implement security controls and establish compliance adherence to all the different types of frameworks that we were trying to meet. And then most recently, I am working for a financial services company and leading up their cloud security engineering and their application security engineering team.
That's awesome. Man, what a varied array of skills and experience. And what I would have our listeners know about Eric, at least from my own personal journals, if you will, is that Eric's one of the most strategic thinkers that I have encountered in my career, which for me is awesome because I'm just not, I wish I were built that way. I wish that was a muscle I had, but it's just not. I'm good at incident response because I'm a bit of a linear thinker and so getting from point A to point B and figuring out all the things in between. But Eric has not only that, but that strategic skill as well, which I love and am not a little jealous of as well. I'll just let you know, Eric.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that, Mick. I don't know where it comes from. You know, maybe it's the musician in me where I just always have to be creative, but I'm always trying to think about, what is the next step? Where are we going next? Because we're doing this today. And as we're all aware, the threat landscape continuously changes. So how do we prepare for what's going to happen next? Even though we don't know what that is. We don't know what type of attack we're going to see. We don't know what new tools are going to come on the market. We don't know what's going to come at us. But we should be thinking, all right, when that does happen, how do we respond? You know, what can we do to prepare now to get us ready for when that happens? And so that's always kind of what's in the back of my mind. It's like, okay, what's the future? Like, what's emerging? Like, what are companies gravitating towards? Oh, now they're doing containers. Like, how do I learn what a container is? How does that actually impact my role in cybersecurity? And what should I be thinking about from a security perspective to prepare myself for whenever IT comes and says, hey, we've now got applications running on containers. Now it's your job to go ahead and secure them.
And I'm sure you and I are the only ones that have had that happen too, but nevertheless, right. I'm glad you brought up creativity, right? Because I, in my experience, and I'd love your thoughts on this. I know this is off script, but at least what the plan was, but I think there's value here. Every time I've talked to great blue teamers, right, who are just pillars in the community in terms of blue teaming defenders, they're largely sort of linear thinkers for the most part. Anytime I speak to brilliant red teamers, they are often really creative people, right? They're musicians, they're artists, they think differently. And I think that allows them to find the flaws in systems better. At least that's been my experience. What do you think?
I think it's a great perspective but I think you also have to have that element of creativity even as a blue teamer.
Sure.
There were so many times where I'm in the role of a digital forensic investigator or incident response, and I have to put myself in the mindset of the creative attacker, the attacker that is doing something that I've never seen before. And how do I put myself in their shoes and think like they think and, try and figure out what they've done? Right. And put the pieces of the puzzle together. But there is an element of creativity in the red team as well. Right. I mean, you've got to try different things. You've got to be okay with failing. You've got to be okay with making mistakes. And you've got to move on and you got to move forward through it and you got to learn through it. Right. The other thing I'd say is also just, reaching out to your network. Collaboration is key. Sometimes those linear thinkers have brilliant ideas, but they just don't know how to like bring them out. And they need that creative mindset to kind of have the conversation. And then all of a sudden you're now collaborating on something. It's whether it's a problem you're solving or whether it's a new attack that you're trying to put together for a red team test. Like that collaboration can spawn new ideas that neither person ever thought until they came together and started talking about it.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. I love that both corporately, but also from a community perspective, that collaboration. You know, there are some really great local conferences, security conferences, where you can get together with other cybersecurity professionals and really just sort of jam off each other in terms of, you know, ideas and, oh, I thought about this, and oh, I saw your talk on that. Have you considered this instead or that approach? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's so fun to see brilliant cybersecurity folks get together, collaborate, and then just really build and take things a little bit further. All right. And with that, we'll kind of jump into the meat of the program. We like to talk about sort of a past, present, and future. In terms of past, tell me about a time that you got into a very interesting investigation that you're allowed to, right? We're all covered by NDAs and legal things. But, what's an interesting attack that you've seen investigated? How did your team respond?
Well, I have lots of them that I can't talk about, obviously, sure. But I've got a couple that I could probably share. So, you know, one of the ones that I thought was really interesting, probably several years ago, this one came out. It was a attack on MySQL databases mm-hmm. that are exposed to the internet. And so there was a ransomware group that was scanning the internet for open MySQL databases and brute forcing those databases. And if they got in, then they would exfiltrate or delete tables and drop tables and then replace it with a ransomware note that says something like, please read me. And then they ask for some type of a ransom payment, usually like inside cryptocurrency. And that is one of the most disruptive attacks that could happen to an organization. Your database is all of a sudden gone, encrypted, doesn't work. Your business operations are stopped. And you've got to figure out what happened, how somebody got in. How are you going to use your backups? Hopefully you've got a backup strategy mm-hmm. To get back online and to get into, you know, business again. I thought that was pretty interesting just because of the speed, right? Mm-hmm. And how quickly it takes for you to just have a, you know, anybody could put up a, you know, a test system or open up a port on, you know, in the cloud or on-prem or whatever, just for some testing real quick. And then all of a sudden you could be compromised. So to me, what's interesting about it is just the speed at how fast those attacks actually occur. And then also, obviously, the implications of it actually happening, right? So I thought that was kind of an interesting attack. I don't know. I've seen some other ones. I got to be careful on which ones I actually talk about because a lot of them are still under attorney-client privilege. And don't want to get into any legal
trouble. No. I don't want anybody going to jail. Some of those. Over this.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's probably the one of the most interesting ones.
Yeah, and I will tell you, you had mentioned, that the attackers were using scanning, web scanning, right, to identify these things. You know, that was, and I think you and I were working together when Shodan really became a thing, mm-hmm. Shodan.io. And, I remember the first time I came across him, I was like, oh my gosh, this is horrible. What a terrible idea. You know, and yet it also, from a vulnerability detection and remediation perspective, or at least detection perspective, it often would give you, if cybersecurity professionals aren't keeping an eye on Shodan for your own environment, I think that's a real miss. Because
absolutely.
I think there's there are times, to your point, where you could spin something up or one of your developers spins something up just for testing. It's just going to take a minute and then somebody gets busy and we don't tear that down. And now we have an exposed service or exposed server that is running. Yeah.
And it becomes easier, right? As mm-hmm. more organizations are leveraging cloud technology and empowering their developers to have more access than ever to, do things in the cloud, open up ports, build their applications, run their applications. How are you continuously monitoring for changes within your environment, configuration issues, opening up different security groups, open up different ports, because it really only takes, you know, a few minutes of a, oops, I didn't know I did that.
Couldn't agree more. And I'm glad you brought up the cloud stuff too, because I remember my last gig as a large Fortune 500 financial services company was moving more and more to the cloud. We started to see and have some, you know, challenging conversations with the development community there, say, you know, because now in the cloud space, what used to be infrastructure changes, you know, in terms of opening firewall rules, ports, those kinds of things that used to be on an on-prem network were infrastructure changes handled by a team that had a broader view of all the other things in play at the time. And there was a set system for evaluating those things. Then with the move to cloud, those became software changes that developers were equipped to make and often did so without necessarily understanding the ramifications of opening, say, port 22 externally, just because, well, but now I can get to it from my house, right? Because we're all working remotely during COVID. Now I can, you know, RDP in, or in this case, SSH in, and test my application without realizing necessarily the broader implications of that. So, I mean, is that an experience? You're a cloud guru. What are your thoughts there?
I think it comes down to really defining your roles and responsibilities of different teams. I mean, I know whenever I first started my cloud journey, everybody was fearful of losing their jobs just because, hey, I've always done things on-prem this way, and then all of a sudden we're going to go to the cloud and it's all going to be automated. And yeah, there's a lot of automation that can really help, you know, empower, innovate, drive speed, you know, new business ideas when you go to the cloud. But at the end of the day, you still have those roles and responsibilities. You still have storage, you still have networking, you still have OS operating infrastructure, middleware. You still have to have some accountability and responsibility of who owns, you know, those different types of changes. You have to have change management in place.
Yes.
So there are things that change dramatically for organizations. There's a new skill set that everybody has to learn. You know, a lot of these things have different names, and then you start even going to multi-cloud, and, you know, different cloud providers have similar services, but just call things different names. So, you know, really what it comes down to is how open you are to learning new things and learning new technology, in my opinion. But if you don't have good oversight and good visibility, and even, you know, I hate to say this, but like reducing complexity of your environment, in a way that, you know, still defines those roles and responsibilities as far as what do my developers have access to do? Like, how much power do they actually have in this cloud? I mean, can they not only build, test, deploy their application, but can they also configure networking? Can they also, you know, add EBS volumes? Can they also, you know, do all of these extra things? And if we don't have governance and oversight of what, you know, their capability is, it's a matter of time before human error just takes over, right? Yep. And all of a sudden, human error causes your business to have true impact and, you know, potential cyber intrusion or data breach or, you know, exploitation, something like that.
Yeah. And I'm glad you said that, right? I mean, if we're honest, at the heart of almost every breach, there's some element of human error, right? Did somebody expose, an S3 bucket? Did they do this? Did they do that? Somebody made a small mistake that wasn't caught that, you know, an enterprising threat actor is going to absolutely jump on.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, it's human error can be as simple as going to the coffee shop to work and have a cup of coffee. And then all of a sudden you get up to use the restroom or refill your coffee and your laptop's left open. You didn't lock your workstation. Somebody walks in, takes it out, and they never got access to all the files that you have on your system.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, that's basic, but it goes a lot further, you know, when you start adding in additional, power for these developers to have, access for these developers to have, not even just developers, just anybody that has access into your system. So it's like, how do we think about, I mean, access control, identity management is a problem that's here to stay. And I don't feel like there's really any good solutions to tackling. There's so many different service accounts, system accounts, user accounts that have all of this incredible access. And, you know, from my perspective, you know, I like Amazon's approach. It's like reduce human access to data as much as possible.
Yes. Yes. Big fan. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And entitlement creep is the other big one that I see often, right? Is that we typically grant folks access to a, you know, a resource for a moment. You just need it for today, except, you know, there isn't a great process to pull that access out, or that process is manual and it fell through, or that guy's on vacation, or whatever the case may be. And suddenly we start to grow, and then not even taking into account when folks move roles and they bring a bunch of previous access with them, and that's not scrubbed out like it ought to be. So entitlement creep is a constant problem. Speaking of problems that we're facing today, what do you think, in your opinion, is kind of the biggest threat facing SOCs today?
I think data is probably the biggest threat to not only SOCs, but even cybersecurity. Data is growing at the fastest pace probably ever. Mm-hmm. And there are so many systems. There's so much data. There's so much complexity. I mean, complexity is also a challenge. Just understanding how an application works with all of its dependencies, with all of its integrations, what it's, who it's talking to. That right there is a major challenge. And then this theme that we keep talking about is, you know, how to stay current with all that is changing in IT, not just security, but IT. Like, how do we, you know, take our security hat off and put our IT hat on and say, all right, what is coming down the pipes? What are the businesses looking at? You know, a few years ago, nobody was looking at Gen AI.
Right.
Now, Gen AI is here and growing so incredibly fast and so easy to use. You know, AI machine learning has been around for a long time. I was doing some work when we were together just on some basic machine learning and some hackathons and things like that. But it was complex. It was difficult to understand. You had to be very technical to make things work. But now you've just got, you know, a prompt, and you can ask basically any question that you want and get very, very accurate information. And so businesses are seeing this, and businesses are like, hey, well, we can use it for all of our technical documentation. We can use it for all of our knowledge bases. We can use it for all of these different use cases. And all of a sudden they want to start using Gen AI. And here, as a SOC analyst or as a security expert, you know, now we're faced with learning that technology. And so, you know, I think one of the biggest challenges is constantly learning and learning the right things, spending your time learning the right things, because, you know, I mean, you could just sit for months at a time and just learn containers. I mean, you could just dive into how containers work, how the access works, what the runtime is, all those things. But you've got to have, in my opinion, you have to have just an open mind to the broader spectrum, right? You got to think about Gen AI. You got to think about IoT. You got to think about, you know, cloud security. You've got to think about all of these things that are coming our way, and also realizing that there's going to be more. And there's going to be more and more data, and there's going to be more and more ways for us to detect attacks. You know, like, think about, I guess, I don't know if this is really a SOC. I guess I'll ask you this. But what about, like, ethically abusing AI? Like, you've got an associate that's got access to ChatGPT or something, and they start asking it these, you know, ethical, you know, concerning questions. Like, who's monitoring that? Who knows, right? Like,
yeah, I mean, so you're right on the cusp of what I think is the next big question around that. Yes, in terms of monitoring, and then the, A, how are you going to do it? How are we getting those logs? Certainly if you're using something commercial, like a ChatGPT, or you're using, you know, Genesis or something along those lines, right? Your options, or Gemini, excuse me, your options to monitor those inputs, apart from maybe like a CASB, are pretty small. Mm-hmm. Right? You may not be able to insert yourself sort of man in the middle, that kind of conversation. Now, if you're hosting your own instance of like a Llama or something along those lines internally, yeah, you can certainly insert yourself in that. But yes, that's going to be a tough one, is understanding what people are asking. Is it appropriate? Are they asking how to, you know, make bombs and these kinds of things? Like that's concerning. Who's monitoring that? Is there an onus on the company's security teams to be catching that? You know, that it's a slippery slope for sure.
Yeah. And, you know, the other thing I'll add is, like, how do you, you know, leverage some of this technology for the role that you're in? Because there's a lot of value, right? There's a lot of good things that you can do. You know, there's a lot of efficiencies that you can gain, in my opinion, by using, you know, Gen AI for your role. If you're unsure about how an attack works, now you can, you know, if you have access to it, you can easily ask these questions and get some relevant information that might help you through your investigation. So I think it's a really powerful tool, but it's also one of those tools that, my opinion is, like, you know, how can I leverage this in order to better my career, grow, learn new things, and, you know, provide the response that's needed for the attacks that I'm seeing.
Yeah. So let me ask you then, what is your favorite use of Gen AI today? What do you use it for most often?
I use it all the time, actually. It's all over the place. If you could see my search history in Gen AI, you'd be like, what? He was asking questions about, you know, personal training, you know, and I'm looking at it right now. I'm like, I've got searches for personal training, for Google project code names, for career planning, like all types of things. So, you know, but to me, you know, it was a very powerful tool for sometimes just writing up some blurbs, right? So like, if I need some professional documentation and I've got a few things going on, I can quickly say, hey, write me up a quick paragraph on this, and then, you know, take it and just wordsmith it and make it my own, customize it my own, but it does a lot of the work for you, right? So that's kind of how I've been leveraging it.
Yeah, I love it. I have, I've been using it primarily for its deconstructive capabilities lately, in terms of like dumping mass tons of data or huge documents in it. The SAN SOC report came out not long ago, yep. The 2024 SOC report, and I didn't have time to read the whole thing. And so I dumped it in and was like, hey, could you please give me the highlights? What are the big things I need to take away? I use that feature all the time, as well as dumping in code snippets. I would just, moment of vulnerability here, not a great coder. Okay.
Oh, me either.
No. Yeah. No. And I have friends who are wonderful, and I still call them today, Stephen DeBolt, you know who you are.
Oh, yeah.
And ask them for assistance from time to time. But more and more, I'm leveraging ChatGPT to dump, you know, code snippets in and say, you know, what exactly is this saying? What is it doing? And it can help me unpack what's happening.
Yeah, I love that. I use it the same way to summarize different types of articles or case studies. I, you know, just give me the highlights, give me the overview. I don't have time to read a 50-page document, but just give me the highlights here real quick. And then all of a sudden, if there's a section I'm interested in, I can dive into it.
Right.
And start looking at it. But I'm the same way with coding too, man. Give me a blank screen and, you know, I'll just sit there and stare at it for an hour.
No, I can be like a shebang, and then from there I'm stuck.
Yeah. Yeah. But you give me somebody else's code, I can tweak it like the best of them.
Yep.
It's just that first step getting started for me on coding.
And not just coding, right? Like the blank page, that is the hard thing to start from. I'm with you. So kind of moving forward then, we talked a little bit about a lot of things that are happening now. where's security operations going? What's coming down the pipes, to use your phrase, what's coming our way that maybe we aren't tracking or should be tracking or is big and we just need to call attention to it?
That's a good question. I think there's a lot of innovation that's happening in cybersecurity right now. There's a lot of really cool startups that are being built by, you know, pioneers in the industry, people that have built, you know, security services for some of these cloud service providers are going off on their own and starting to build out some of these new startups. You look at Wiz is a great example.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of those founders came from Microsoft. You know, they built out some security services within Microsoft and then went out and they started Wiz and, you know, grew that company to one of the fastest growing, you know, cybersecurity companies in the industry. So looking at innovative startups, I think is going to be a game changer, just because there's so much talent out there and there's so many problems to solve. Finding that right problem, finding, you know, those customers, those use cases that are going to solve it is key. The other thing that's coming is, you know, I don't know for sure, you know, if this is going to really change security operations or not, but it's starting to change the developer world. And what we're starting to see is like some of these developers using these, going back to the whole Gen AI thing, is using these AI like sidecars or sidekicks, so to speak, mm-hmm. right? Copilot. I've heard that term, copilot, right? So being able to, you know, do the job that you're doing today, but also having that SOC copilot where you can ask it questions, you can feed it data, you can feed it scenarios, and it can give you real-time responses on, hey, have you thought about this, and this. You know, let's just say, for instance, you've got Security Operations Center that has a bunch of processes and procedures. You feed that into your, you know, Gen AI. All of a sudden, it's, you know, knowledgeable on all of those things. And you come across an attack and you just want to make sure you're following procedures. You type in your question to it. It spits it out and says, make sure you do these 10 things. Maybe you already are doing those things. But I think that, you know, just having that assistant, having that little co-pilot that can give you, you know, make you faster, be more innovative, accurate, quality. Those are all things that I think is coming towards, you know, security operations, but I don't really, you know, see that changing very much. I mean, you know, we're always going to need to have monitoring in place. We're always going to need to have people like, yeah, sure, you can apply a bunch of different AI to it, but there's still going to be somebody that needs to supervise it all, make sure it's all working, make sure it's all working together, integrated together. You ensure all of your systems are continuously logging. You know, if I were to look into the crystal ball, I don't see it changing a whole lot. What I see is it becoming more empowered to do things faster, to do things more efficient. And then also the challenge of securing more and more systems, you know, understanding different types of networking, infrastructure, applications, identity, compliance, all of those things.
Okay. Still I love it.
Relatively important.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So let me ask you this, because you touched on some interesting things in there, and I want to kind of double click into a few of them. One of them was around, right, if you could feed in your sort of your runbook process procedures for analysis of a variety of different use cases. If you could feed something like that into an AI system, a machine learning system that has now lots and lots of data, previous decisions and how those have worked through, do you think there's a time when at least the tier one analysis is fully automated by an AI bot of some sort? And let me unpack that a little bit more just to give you clarity and for the listeners. What I'm saying is not that analysts wouldn't be there, not that AI is replacing analysts, but that a lot of that initial data enrichment, false positive elimination, all of that is done, that currently is being done by a tier one analyst, human analyst, could be later done by an AI machine learning bot that then brings higher fidelity, higher efficacy alerts to, that are fully data enriched to a tier two analyst.
In my opinion, I think if that were to happen, it should be built within to the correlation engine that you're using, right? So the tool that you're using should be mm-hmm. providing that tier one. And I swear I've had a vendor try and sell me that exact thing before. You know, and I'm like, wait a second, I call BS. I don't really think that your tool can do all that. You know, I still think I'm going to need that tier one analysis. And in all cases I did, but yeah, I mean, you know, I think the better that we can get at understanding, you know, what's actually happening. And to me, I've had this complaint for a long time with security vendors. It's your tool's too complex. Like, you know, I've got to train my team hours upon hours just to use your solution.
Yes.
And if somebody leaves and I have to hire somebody else, then I have to train that person hours and hours on how to use your solution. And it's so customized for our environment that, you know, am I really getting the value out of it that, you know, I'm paying for? That's a hard problem to solve. It really is. I mean, I think if you can get a more simplistic view of what is happening across your environment and be able to manage it, respond to it, prevent different types of, you know, attacks from occurring using this solution, you've got gold right there. I don't think it exists, because all of a sudden, like I was talking about my career when I started, right? We had two tools. We had a IDS sensor and a firewall. And that's how we were securing. We were securing major companies with that. Like that was it. Today, how many security tools do organizations have? Do they even know? That's my question. Do they even know how many they have? Oftentimes they don't.
It's okay. Right? We're going to buy a tool that will tell us what tools we have.
Yeah. And then we'll only use like 15% of it. We won't fully operationalize it.
Yes. Oh, that's frustrating. Don't get me started, Eric.
I'm not.
But you're right. I mean, that is, as a security professional, that's always been one of the biggest frustrations, is that we buy these very, very expensive, very elaborate tools that are incredibly complex to manage and to implement properly. You know, McDouglas. I had McDouglas on, you know, a couple of months ago now. And he has a whole company who's devoted to helping folks like get the most out of their solutions because they can't. And it's such a specialized skill that, you know, you often need a consultant to come in and help you really, especially if you want to get time to value. Mm-hmm. You know, yes, we could spend 2 years figuring this out, learning. I could send folks to training. They're going to come back. We'll try and fail, try and fail, try and maybe succeed. Or we can bring in an expert who does this for a living and get time to value in 6 months instead of mm-hmm. 2 years. Right. And these are the decisions that CISOs like you, you know, certainly in your last gig and certainly even now as a cloud security leader and AppSec leader, you've got to make those decisions.
Yeah. No, you want to have confidence, right? That you're investing in solutions that are protecting your company and mm-hmm. that are not leaving you vulnerable to attacks. And it's hard to, you know, really show that confidence, you know, with these solutions, aside from saying, well, we haven't been breached in 5 years. Right.
Right.
But tomorrow it could happen.
Absolutely. Okay. Bridging forward here. Yeah. Great discussion so far. And I thank you for that. We always love to talk about getting into a security operations role, right? So some career guidance. If we have some listeners today that are thinking, man, this sounds freaking awesome. I want to do that. Yep. You know, you talked about digital forensics and cloud security and AppSec and middleware. And I mean, IT, the whole thing. I want to be part of this. What advice would you give them? How do you get started? What's the pathway?
So first of all, I love this question because I'm very passionate about helping others get into cybersecurity. Mm. I get asked that question more often than not from all different types of people. People who are just graduating high school and looking for, you know, what they should do in college, and they're somewhat interested in cybersecurity, and they ask me some questions about it. Or from people that are in the middle of a career that they hate and they want to get into cyber because they've heard really cool things about it. or people that are even in cybersecurity and want to move on to their next role. So, you know, first and foremost, what I would say is, you know, feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn. I love to give people advice and have conversations about this. So I'm open, you know, add me to your network. I'm open to have conversations about this. But the way that I look at it is, you know, really look at the entire roadmap of roles in cybersecurity and figure out what you're passionate about and what you're excited about and what you could see yourself doing day in and day out. And then build yourself a career plan around that particular role. Now, you may not be able to, you know, land that role as an entry level, you know, professional, but you can build a plan to get yourself there, right? So maybe your first role in cybersecurity is, you know, security operations center analyst. You know, I've seen a lot of people who have went the help desk path and got a, you know, a role on IT help desk, learn how to troubleshoot, learn how to problem solve. Those are two key skills that you absolutely need as a security operations center.
Yes.
You can learn the tools. Like, you know, it's not a matter of all the experience that you have using those tools. Tools can be learned. What it is just having that mindset and being able to, you know, figure out, you know, how do I respond to this? What would I do in this situation? Who would I inform? So I'd say that, you know, second piece of advice I would say is, you know, really leverage your network, build your network, get out to events. You're talking about local conferences. Mm-hmm. They're relatively inexpensive. There's many, many that are free online. And, you know, there's oftentimes you can listen to these things in the background, right? You don't have to be fully engaged, but you can, you know, have them on when you go for a walk. You can, you know, listen to them in the car, whatever it is. You know, I think there's a lot of value there. And then, you know, third of all, home labs. I'm a huge fan of doing things at home, get the hands-on experience with the open source tools that are available. There's so many tutorials. There's no excuse to, you know, in my opinion, there's no excuse to show up to a job interview and say that you've got, you know, all of these cybersecurity certifications, but yet haven't even done anything hands-on. Right. Download some tools, run it in a lab. You can run it in the cloud for free these days. Learn those security native services. And when you get that interview, you show up and you say, I've got this home lab. I've ran all of these different tools. I know how to do vulnerability scanning. I got a web application firewall. I've got a SIM set up in my lab. I simulate all of these attacks, and this is how I would actually respond to it. That, to me, is going to go a lot further than just trying to tell me that you've passed some certification test. I mean, there's value in certifications. Absolutely. I'm not saying that there's not, because I have several of them and I believe in them. And there's values in degree programs too, as well, because I have degrees as well. But I think that being able to demonstrate that you've gone above and beyond outside of those certifications and those degrees is going to differentiate yourself when it comes time for interviewing. I mean,
yes.
Would you agree, Mick? You've interviewed a lot of people too, right? We were on a lot of interviews together.
We were. Yeah, no. And I agree wholeheartedly, right? I mean, I love to see, and I, you know, I've spoken about this. Our longtime listeners will know that this is an area I too am passionate, because, you know, I think the folks that I have always seen be most successful in, especially security operations roles, anything operations, engineering, architecture, the more hands-on aspect of cybersecurity, the folks I've seen be very successful there are tinkerers by nature. Mm-hmm. Right. These are the folks that, you know, aren't afraid to roll up their sleeves and build a box, you know, build their first computer, aren't afraid to open the hood of their car and, you know, figure out how things work, you know, change a radio, whatever the case may be. Just shoot the last gig, well, 2 gigs ago, one of the guys we hired was like a drone builder. So he used to awesome. Just build racing drones for yep. giggles on the side.
Yep.
So it's whatever you're into, you know, it's hands-on tinkering that I think will ultimately set you apart, because then you're applying head knowledge and making it tangible hands-on knowledge.
Yep.
And I think there's value there.
And I think the thing that often goes unspoken is, because I 100% agree with you, but is the repetition and the discipline, because you can't just spend time tinkering with something for 8 hours on a weekend and say, yep, I'm good.
Just right? One time. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I look at it like, you know, it's like, you know, if you go to a personal trainer, if you go to the gym and you're trying to lose weight or you're trying to gain muscle, whatever it is, set that goal and you have to work on it, right? You can get started, but if you don't keep going and you know, don't keep learning and keep trying different things, you know, it's going to hold you up. I think you're not going to accomplish that goal. So, you know, set realistic goals, you know, learn a new tool in 30 days. It can be done. It's not hard. There's YouTube tutorials out there. There's podcasts, lots of resources. Like back in my day, I had 5 books at the bookstore that I could go get to learn cybersecurity. And guess what? I bought those 5 books and I learned them. I did.
I know. I get it. But now, right, with the internet at our disposal, with YouTube, and I mean, even things like TikTok. I mean, there's just so many avenues to learning that there's really no excuse for not going after it.
Yep.
So agreed wholeheartedly. Okay, listen, last question, I promise. If someone can only take away one thing from our conversation that's been pretty wide-ranging, what would you have them hear? What would you have them take away from you as kind of the one thing?
Be open to change, adapt to emerging technology, continuously learn. That would be my biggest takeaway. That is what you need in this role. Don't expect to, you know, be in a cybersecurity role and do the same thing day in and day out. You're going to get new things thrown your way, and be open to those new things. If you don't understand it, ask questions, ask your peers, ask your network, read books, research it, ask Gen AI. A lot of times they got the answer. Right.
I love it.
Right. So, you know, that's the takeaway for me. It's just like, and that's what's kept me so interested in this industry and in this field, is that it continuously changes. There are brand new teams that are being created. I'm sure that these probably already exist, but there's probably already, you know, AI security engineers out there.
Oh yeah.
That didn't even exist a few years ago. But now there's teams, there's roles, there's opportunities to land a job as an AI security engineer.
I have seen roles that are like prompt security engineer, or in, you know, prompt injection specialist.
Yep.
You know, crazy stuff that you know, 2 years didn't exist.
Never existed.
Now does.
Right.
So awesome. Well, Eric, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. What a great conversation that we've had. It has been a genuine pleasure to have you on the show.
I appreciate your time, Mick. It was a lot of fun, and best of luck to you.
All right. Well, thanks, Eric. I appreciate it. Folks, this has been SOC Unlocked, Tales from the Cybersecurity Front Lines. I'm Mick Leach, your host, and reminding all of you cyber defenders out there to keep fighting that good fight. You're the tip of the spear, so stay sharp. Thanks for tuning in. Don't forget to like and subscribe and check out our other SOC Unlocked episodes. We'll see you all next time. Thanks.